As someone who cares about addressing global poverty, I think doing conservation programs has this extra benefit of having some positive spillovers on the world's neediest people.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. As more people consume more, we destroy more of our natural environment. But how ethical are conservation policies that reduce the income of the world's poorest people? And how do we create policies that work both for the planet and for all of us who live on it? In the second of our episodes that examine the policy implications of the topics that are being raised in the BREAD IGC virtual PhD course in environmental economics, I'm talking to Seema Jayachandran of Princeton and Ben Olken of MIT about the economics of conservation. Seema, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks, Tim.
And Ben, welcome as well.
Thanks, Tim. Delighted to be here.
We have to think about the impacts of environmental damage in low-income countries, middle-income countries, that we can see and we can measure. What are those impacts?
There's a wide range of impacts. Let me start with a couple of different types of things. One thing that we think about are the impacts of global climate change. And I think here, the research has shown that the impacts are quite broad, and maybe even broader mm-hmm. than you might expect. So I think lots of people think that there would be impacts in agriculture, and that's definitely true. Obviously, if it's too hot, or in particular, if there are droughts, that has quite severe and immediate consequences for agriculture, particularly rain-fed agriculture, which is prevalent in many low and middle-income countries. But I think what the literature has shown is that those impacts can be much broader. For example, some research that I've actually done has looked at the impact of higher temperatures and economic growth. Mm-hmm. And we find substantial reductions in economic growth in hotter years compared to in cooler years, particularly in poorer countries. And the research suggests it's not just about agriculture, but actually we're seeing it across the economy. We also see impacts on mortality. So just direct health consequences of it being too hot, that has direct consequences for people's health. That's within the existing span of temperatures that we're seeing. In some places, as I think many people saw in the news this year, the temperatures are starting to reach new extremes. Those health consequences could be even more severe. Maybe a third one that people wouldn't have necessarily guessed, but I think is also true, is labor productivity. So people seem to be less productive when it's really hot out, and that has really severe consequences.
I think pollution and heat and storms are going to disrupt people's lives and is disrupting people's lives already. And particulate matter, which is the fine particles that create smog, some of the same mm-hmm. impacts Ben talked about, lower labor productivity. There's also evidence it reduces how much kids learn in school. So the next generation, their mental health effects. It's really quite shocking how widespread and devastating the effects of air pollution can be.
In the introduction, I made that equivalence between consumption and the environmental harm, the destruction of the natural environment. Is this actually true? As we get richer, is it inevitable this will lead to more environmental harm or different? Or is there a possibility there might be less?
Especially for low and middle income countries, this is a really important question. I think all would say that all things being equal, we want a cleaner environment for all mm-hmm. the reasons we just talked about, but you know, also just per se, it's a planet we've inherited. But we also want the world's poorest people to have an opportunity to get richer. And as they get richer, you know, I think it could go either way. I think there are lots of reasons we should be expecting a larger carbon footprint as the poorest countries get richer. People can afford air conditioning and refrigerators and cars and eat more. And those are all opportunities that those of us who were raised and live in rich countries have had. So, you know, we don't want to deprive poorer people of those. I think there are also some reasons for hope that with economic resources, you can improve governance and so have better regulatory capacity. People might be willing to sacrifice a little bit of their income to buy a cleaner version of a product because it's not hurting their well-being too much. So, you know, I think we can't be overly optimistic that economic development is going to solve our problem of the environment, but there are certainly some bright spots, but we have to be ready to think about those trade-offs along the way.
The basic first order fact probably is that as people get richer, they're going to consume more energy. Mm-hmm. I think energy consumption increases with incomes. And so as people move from low income status to middle income status across the world, I think that the first thing we should expect is that they're going to consume more energy, and that's going to lead to more carbon emissions, for example. So I agree with Seema that there's hope that future energy consumption may be less carbon intensive than it has been in the past as we shift to alternative power sources. But the first order thing we're dealing with is that I think that, as Seema said, you know, for lots of good reasons, as people become wealthier, they're going to consume more energy, and that's going to lead to more carbon emissions. As countries become richer, it may be that their ability to adapt, particularly to climate change, also becomes more feasible. I mean, take air conditioning as one example. Not that air conditioning is a perfect adaptation device, but it's a lot easier to withstand a really hot day if you have air conditioning and can be inside than if you don't. And so I think that that can be really important. There are other forms of adaptation as well. Better quality buildings with better HVAC, for example, can deal with particulate matter potentially better. So I think those are things that we may see as countries become richer, that they may be able to adapt better. So I think you can see both aspects of that.
Ben, in your lecture, there are some extraordinary photos that you showed from about 2005, I think they are, of the Amazonia region, where you can see where the border between Brazil and neighboring countries is, because on the Brazilian side, there's no trees. Why did that happen?
It's really stark. And in fact, just to tell you a story of how we started this research, my collaborators and I were actually just looking at some Google Earth photos of South America right. with no borders. We're just looking at maps of forests. And we saw these really distinct lines. And someone said, wait a second, isn't that the Brazilian border? And in fact, it was so obvious.
Yeah.
And in fact, I remember a few years ago, I was at a conference in Bolivia and flying home, and you could look out the window and you could just tell, like, when you know, your plane across the border into Brazil, it was that stark.
Wow.
So what's going on? I think the answer is a few different things. There were different policies in Brazil going back 50 years, encouraging more development in more rural regions. By the period that we start studying, a lot of the deforestation was officially not allowed, but I think the enforcement was relatively weak and the penalties were relatively weak. And one of the things that we document is as those policies shifted and changed in Brazil, you can see these impacts on annual deforestation rates, right? Sort of, if you look kind of across the border, you can see those, the Brazil effect kind of really being quite dramatic.
So the solution in this case was to just crank up the legal environment, is it?
You know, I think it's not just tougher laws, it's also increased enforcement. Mm-hmm. And one of the themes of some of my research is there's a difference between what the laws are on the books and yep. how they're actually enforced. And I think that mm-hmm. in the Brazilian case, it was a combination of those things. It was a combination of strengthening some of the penalties for deforestation, but also putting in place a robust monitoring infrastructure using satellite data, pretty aggressive crackdowns on some of the places that were doing the most deforestation. And other people, I should have done a lot of the work figuring out what the impact of those different policies were. I think our point is to say, on aggregate, what was the total effect of them? So I think it was not just changing the laws on the books, that was important, but that plus increased enforcement worked together.
And when we talk about enforcement, of course, that raises all sorts of tricky problems. Another piece of your research was done in Indonesia, where you looked at the gap between the national policy and the local enforcement. Why would there be a space between the local officials and the national policy that local officials are not implementing it?
Stepping back a minute, one of the challenges with environment is that there can be divergent interests between the people who are managing the local resources, in our case, the forests, mm-hmm. and the broader community that receives benefits from those. For example, at some level, some of the benefits from forests are about their global carbon sinks, and they are providing global benefits in terms of climate change. They're also really important for biodiversity considerations. Mm-hmm. Those are things that the global world community might care about, maybe the national government might care about, but a local politician who's considering the welfare of his or her own constituents might care only about what the economic benefits are. So there's a divergence of interests there. And part of the challenge in regulation is about making sure that those global benefits or the national benefits are in fact taken into account by the people who are actually making decisions. But you can easily see why there might be divergent interests. And you see that around the world, that sometimes there could be national or global interest in conserving, but the local population says, no, we want to get the economic benefits from this resource, for example. So that's a fundamental tension. There can be other reasons for divergent interests. There also could be potentially a corruption-related consequences. Mm-hmm. The things I said before, assuming perfect democracy where local politicians are representing their voters, there's another thing that could be happening, which is actually maybe the politicians could be captured by local interests in a variety of ways. And you could imagine both of those being important.
How do you make a testable hypothesis out of this in this case?
Indonesia is an enormous country. And following the fall of Suharto in 1998, Indonesia decentralized many things, many forms of government to the local level, to the district level. And there were 280-something districts at the time, and including the local management of forests. Although the national policy was set at the forest ministry in Jakarta, the local management of who's actually kind of monitoring what the people in the forest are doing and helping kind of facilitate that was actually at the local district officials, or district offices who were responsible to the local district governments. Over the first 10 years or so after Indonesia's decentralization, the number of Indonesian districts almost doubled. They went from having 280 districts to 500-something districts. Mm-hmm. And districts basically split in half or split into thirds. So they became more districts. And that happened in different times in different places. So the empirical thing that we look at in the data is whether increased decentralization by the splitting of districts led to more deforestation. And we find evidence of that. So we find that we use satellite data to track deforestation across all the main forest areas of Indonesia. We look at those provinces that at a given point in time experienced a change in the number of districts and therefore an increased amount of decentralization. And we show that in this particular case led to more deforestation.
Why would it?
One hypothesis we have in the paper is that those districts are competing with each other. Who can be the one that gets the benefits from extracting forest resources? And those benefits could be legal benefits, right? We get more resources or more economic activity, or they could be potentially bribes that are paid to local district officials. And actually, the Indonesian National Anti-Corruption Commission, the KPK, has actually subsequently gone after several district heads and local politicians for illegal activity related to deforestation. So the idea that there could be illegal activity here is consistent with what the KPK has subsequently found. So it could be either way. In the corrupt example, we think of it as the theory of competition, which if there's only one person, they're the monopolist. They're going to charge a relatively high price and have relatively less quantity. As there's competition between potential district officials, they may start underbidding each other, and it becomes easier for someone to say, okay, well, you know, if person A is going to charge me a lot to let me do what I want to do, then maybe person B, I can go to person B, and they can compete against each other, and that could lead to more extractive efforts. The empirical fact is we definitely see increased decentralization leading to more deforestation in this period.
You've also investigated how the democratic process influences this enforcement. How would it? Does it?
Well, again, we have these local district officials. They're called bupatis. They're the heads of the local districts. You could think of it's at one level kind of below a provincial governor, but they're still elected. And they're the ones who are the supervision authority over the local district forest office. So the question is, what happens when they run for re-election? How does that change things? There's a long tradition in economics and political science that shows that there are political cycles in different kinds of economic activity and different kinds of government policy. Politicians do different things when they're running for re-election, when voters are most paying attention. We use the fact that the elections in local government in Indonesia in the period we study happened at different times at different districts. They were on different cycles for different historical reasons. And they subsequently been synchronized, but at the time they were in different cycles. And so we can say, well, what happens if over here there's an election, whereas over here there's not, and vice versa? And so we can show that there's a relationship between what's happening in the forest sector and the local political timing. In particular, decline in what looks like forest clearing and forest burning, because also forest fires are potentially associated with forest clearing in this context around the election years. And then it goes back up afterwards. It seems as though in this case, the political cycle has a dip when the voters are most paying attention, but goes back up afterwards.
Seema, you've been talking about the link between poverty and conservation initiatives. This is something that comes up in the news over and over again. There are many people who would say that these conservation initiatives proposed and driven by high-income countries are fundamentally anti-poor. Do they have a point?
I think the first thing to say is that if globally we're able to put a halt to climate change, if we can mitigate climate change, that's a very pro-poor achievement. You know, all of the costs of climate change that Ben talked about, we have abundant evidence. And just logically, a lot of those costs, the harm, the mortality is going to be borne by the world's poorest people. So solving climate change is very pro-poor. Then there's the question of how do we achieve that? And if the policy is everybody needs to do their bit, that might be an anti-poor approach in the sense that the cost of setting aside some money to address climate change, people are going to feel the pinch of that more if they're already poor. Or something like a carbon tax, which from an economic point of view sounds like a great way to get people to do less of what's bad for the environment, namely emit carbon. Mm-hmm. If that's a bigger part of the budget of poorer people, then that policy can be anti-poor in the sense it's hurting the economic well-being of someone who's already poor.
I've been talking with Ben about some of the policies that happen at national government and local government level. Are there policies that can create or incentivize pro-environment behavior at a household level that don't make poverty worse? Is this possible?
You need to go from a national goal to getting often people to change their behavior. And one way we could do that is we could say we're going to tax the activity that's creating a negative externality for the environment. We can ban it. But those all have the problem that if someone was, for example, cutting down forests to use that land for agriculture to feed their family or selling those trees to pay for hospital bills, then banning it is going to make them worse off. That's exactly the example of an anti-poor policy. And so one kind of policy that I've studied is what's called Payments for Ecosystem Services, or PES. And that's the idea of giving financial rewards to people if they do the pro-environment activity. So it's really just flipping the idea of a fine on its head and say, instead of getting penalized for it, you're getting rewarded if you don't do it. Hmm. And so that's a program where if individuals or households or communities own forests or other sorts of natural resources, you can get them to change their behavior, but in a way that's first is, you know, hopefully making them a little bit better off economically, but more importantly, it's a choice. So if they feel like this is going to impoverish them, they can say no. And it has a nice feature, which economists like for a good reason, which is there's a market aspect to this. There might be two landowners who own forests. One is a spectacular farmer who has really rich land for agriculture. They can be really productive on their couple hectares of land. If they can deforest it and feed their community, that might be the right trade-off we make. You know, their neighbor might not be a very good farmer. They might not have very productive land for agriculture. It would be a shame if they cut their forest. And so once you offer a reward, the hope is that the first one says, no, thank you. That price is not as much as my profits. The second one says, this is a great deal. This is helping me be better off than I would otherwise be. And you know, from the environment, we got some extra forests still standing.
You were involved in an experiment in Uganda based around this principle. What was the problem in this case?
Western Uganda has some really rich natural forests that's important for biodiversity. It's the habitat of chimpanzees, which are an endangered species. So when the forest starts getting degraded, we risk losing chimpanzees from this planet. There are also butterflies and really unique species of flora and fauna. And then just broadly, globally, the other reason we care about forests is they're a carbon sink. You know, when you cut down a tree, that big tree trunk is mostly carbon atoms and they go up into the atmosphere. And so, you know, that's all the global benefits of keeping the forest intact. But people who own forests, they were very poor and they were clearing a few hectares to sell the trees for school fees or to have an extra meal in the week to pay for hospital bills or, you know, to grow food. And so we're balancing two things, the economic well-being of very poor people, but also this rich forest that globally we would like to keep in place.
So in this case, how much did you pay people to keep the forest intact? Did it work?
Yes, we did a randomized experiment where we tried out a policy that of PES, or Payments for Ecosystem Services, where forest owners were offered $28 per hectare. A hectare is about three-fourths of a soccer field. You know, $28 per hectare if they kept the forest intact. So that's not a lot of money. Most people own 2 hectares, so they can make $56 a year from this program. This had a big impact on the amount of deforestation. There was still deforestation even in the villages where this was offered because it was optional and some people chose to continue deforesting, but you got a 50% reduction in the amount of deforestation. And I should add, it's not obvious that you were going to get a reduction because, you know, the challenge with programs like this is you put a contract that says, if you keep your forest intact, we'll pay you. And then you go ahead and do that. The problem is that maybe a lot of the people who sign up and got payment, they were the ones who weren't going to cut their forest anyway. And so the actual amount of new conservation you get out of this is not so clear cut. And so this was the advantage of having these control villages where we could see, you know, absent this program, 9% of forests were cut down in 2 years. And then we got that cut in half by having this program in place.
Very often, the natural environment, that's quite hard to value. for a program like this? Does it become easier to do a benefit cost analysis? Were you able to do one? What did it come up with?
For many kinds of environmental benefits, like keeping chimpanzees from going extinct, we don't know where to start in terms of thinking of the economic benefits. You know, one thing that the scientific community has done a good job with is for carbon and climate change, you know, there's numbers for how much is the global damage if we emitted an extra ton of carbon dioxide. And that's very useful because for a program like this, we can convert the gains in forest to how many tons of carbon dioxide did we prevent from going up into the atmosphere. We can put a dollar value on that using what's called the social cost of carbon. And then we can think about how much did this program cost and was it cost effective? So we can go from how many hectares of forest were saved. We can use some scientific estimates of the amount of carbon that was stored in those forests, some extra assumptions, and then we can use the off-the-shelf estimates of the social cost of carbon. And in this case, the program was hugely cost effective, you know, probably a benefit to cost ratio of 15. And maybe more importantly than that is that, you know, you don't even need to think about the social cost of carbon. You could just think about all the different options we have for mitigating climate change and protecting forests in Uganda through this approach. You know, looks cheaper than some of the other things we're doing, like subsidizing electric vehicles in the US or trying to convert green concrete in China, etc.
15 is an amazing number. So is it possible then to get a win-win, protect the environment and protect the livelihoods of the people who you are tasking with preserving the environment?
There's still a choice of who should fund this kind of program.
Yeah.
My comparison to electric vehicle subsidies in the US is that this should be part of the options that the UK government or the US government is thinking about when trying to mitigate climate change. If citizens in the US are willing to put a certain amount of money towards climate change, we could say we're only going to do things within our borders and we're going to lose out on these benefit cost ratio 15 opportunities in Uganda. So, you know, I think we can think about funding these from richer countries who, you know, we all know are the ones who created the problem of climate change just because of historical emissions. But I think it's important to realize that this kind of policy is not solving the problem of poverty. We're compensating that Ugandan farmer was getting $56 a year for his 2 hectares of forest, but in exchange, he was changing his behavior and not getting money from selling timber. And so, you know, you might lose $50 in income from selling timber. We paid you $56, so you're better off, but you're better off by $6 in my example, not by $56. And I think this is just an important point to make. We want to think about achieving conservation in a way that doesn't exacerbate poverty. We have to be careful not to double count this and call this development aid. You know, there's still other kinds of policies that you need to lift those Ugandan families out of poverty.
The costs of conservation programs, they are inevitably local, however we want to define local. The benefits are global. Does this mean that inevitably conservation programs are going to be underfunded?
It's not inevitable, but you're right. The basic economic theory would suggest there's some problems here. In particular, there's also a free rider problem. Mm. Maybe an even bigger problem is the fact that we have different countries who potentially free ride in each other. So one of the big challenges with global climate change is what matters is the total amount of global emissions. If, you know, U.S. climate change was only influenced by U.S. emissions and U.K. climate change was only influenced by U.S. emissions, it would in some ways be an easier problem to solve because each country would figure out what they needed to do for themselves.
Yeah.
One of the many reasons that makes this a really hard problem is there's this temptation to free ride, because actually what matters is global emissions. So any one country is only doing a small piece of the global puzzle. That suggests that the amount of investment in conservation for those reasons is probably going to be underfunded. Mm-hmm. All that being said, I think that the world is increasingly recognizing that this is a really important global problem and that, you know, all the countries around the world are going to need to do something about this, I think, given the extreme damages that we're starting to see. So that suggests hopefully that countries can come together and sort of solve that problem. But the underlying economic forces illustrate why this is a challenge.
Flipping the logic on its head, climate change is a global externality. If one country wants to solve the problem, just help its citizens, it has a worldwide set of options. So if you were trying to solve particulate matter or some local pollution in the US government, you just had to look at the options within the US, or the same thing for the UK. In this case, you can look to Uganda or Brazil, and there might be some global bargains. And so that does mean if we get some of the countries with deep pockets to commit money, we can search around the globe and find some real bargains. And, you know, and I wanted to make the point that this is not going to solve poverty, but it usually does have some local benefits. And so as someone who cares about addressing global poverty, I think doing conservation programs in Uganda or Brazil has this extra benefit of having some positive spillovers on the world's neediest people.
I was talking to the IMF last week, and they were very keen to stress the depth and the importance of what they called economic headwinds in 2023 and for a few years beyond, especially for low-income countries. Does this mean that it's likely they will reduce their commitment to conservation just because there are very few policy choices?
I think that's a real worry, that when times are tough, we'll cut back on things that seem like they're further out. I think one of the big changes in the last, I don't know, 2 years, 5 years, is a realization that climate change is here today and not in the future. And so hopefully that will mitigate some of the worry that will push this one off. You know, coming back to the global idea, I think part of what's going to happen is governments are going to try to use climate policy or conservation as economic stimulus. And so that's going to mean maybe focusing domestically, job creation through, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act kind of idea. And, you know, I would say that coming back to my point that we should be looking globally, I think maybe one of the reactions will be to also shift where the conservation happens and not just reduce the amount.
I agree with Seema that these things do get more challenging. On the other hand, this is a long-run global problem, and I'm hopeful that the way to think about what we need to do is to make longer-term policy changes that aren't as related to a particular business cycle as a way of combating this long-term problem. If we're always in a world where the extent we're sort of doing stuff is depending on the business cycle that particular year, that doesn't seem like a really good recipe to solve this long-run problem.
The recent news from Amazonia, it shows that there has been a reduction in deforestation. I hesitate to call it good news, but it's certainly less bad news. Is there something that we can take from this? A policy lesson that can be applied more generally?
If we look at the period that we were studying, we saw multiple shifts in the levels of deforestation. You know, we found a really high levels, then we found a decrease, then we found it went back up again. In my mind, I think the question that I want to understand is, what's important to make these policies sustainable? And is there something that's going on, maybe in the political process, by which when they try to crack down, people who are cracked down against fight back through the political process? And so what do we need to understand why these cycles are happening and how to make them sustainable? And actually, that's something that in ongoing work, we're trying to understand. I don't have an answer for you yet, but it's something that I'm very much thinking about, is why are these policies not necessarily so sustainable in the political process? And are there things that one can therefore do to make them more sustainable?
There is so much to think about this, and there is so much work to be done. Delighted that you're both doing it. Thank you very much for talking about it today as well. Seema, thank you.
Thanks, Tim. My pleasure.
And Ben as well.
Thanks. This has been terrific.
This course that we've been talking about is free. You can sign up for it. And for more information, you want to register, you want to download the slides from the lectures and the reading list as well, go along to the IGC website, which is theigc.org, and you'll find all the information there. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is subscribe. Go on, do it now. You will find us wherever you get your podcasts from. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org. You'll also find articles about the papers we featured in our previous episodes.